Welcome to the debate. You know, usually when we talk about diagnosing a massive problem, there is this this expectation of precision.
Right, like it's a hard science.
Exactly. It's like engineering or maybe medicine. You break your arm, you go to the hospital, the x-ray shows that, you know, that jagged white line on the screen, and the doctor just points and says, "There it is. That's what's broken."
Yeah, it's very binary. The bone is broken or it's not broken. The fix is clean.
Right, and it's comforting. We fundamentally like things to be visible and categorized.
But then you step into the world of civilizational repair and planetary governance.
Oh, yeah. A whole different ballgame. Completely. You look at climate crises, institutional collapse, global security, and suddenly you realize that x-ray machine is broken. We're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is profoundly murky. And the tools we use to measure the problem might actually be causing the disease.
Which perfectly sets up what we are digging into today. We are exploring Dr. Bechara Sali's academic white paper, Keeping Life Coherence Alive. And it is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters.
It really is.
Sali is looking at how our global systems, from climate governance to economics to security, have completely lost their answerability to living systems.
Yeah, and he builds this incredible framework based on Humberto Maturana's biology of cognition. He's essentially proposing a radical shift. Right now, institutions prioritize their own self-preservation, right? But Sahaly argues we need to shift that to the conservation of what he calls life capacity.
But of course, the second you say something like, we need a new framework for global governance, you run into a massive wall. I mean, how do you actually do that without creating just another useless bureaucracy?
And that is the central question we are debating today. Can we successfully operationalize this concept of life coherence through formal audits and frameworks to achieve real civilizational repair? Or does institutionalizing this concept inherently trigger the exact same bureaucratic capture, the idolatry, really, that the author warns against?
It's a huge question.
So I'll state my position right off the bat. I believe Sahaly's framework provides a robust, actionable defense against institutional capture. Through its built-in recursive audits and a practice he calls distinction hygiene, it offers a rigorous tool for planetary governance without becoming, you know, a rigid dead doctrine.
And my position is that translating life coherence into an auditing tool paradoxically guarantees its capture. By formalizing this framework, we inevitably transform it into the ultimate golden calf.
Interesting.
Yeah, it becomes just another compliance metric that global bureaucracies will absorb to protect their own reputations, and it will completely fail to interrupt the very life-destroying systems it was meant to cure.
Okay, well, let me start by laying out why this framework is so necessary, and it begins with how we use words. Human civilization lives by distinctions. We distinguish security from threat, value from waste, development from backwardness.
Mm-hmm.
Maturana's foundational insight, the biology of cognition piece, is that these distinctions aren't just objective, passive observations of a pre-divided world. They are operations in living. They organize how we perceive reality, and more importantly, they authorize action.
Right. A distinction gives you permission to do something.
Exactly. When a distinction loses its answerability to life, when, for example, a nation defines security strictly as militarized border control, completely regardless of the ecological or human cost, it authorizes violence under the guise of progress.
Sure.
So Sahaly solves the problem of corrective capture through the recursive audit by continually asking what happens to life when this distinction is used in this way. The framework forces institutions to measure actual relational life capacity rather than just their symbolic performance. It's not a passive philosophy, it's a rigorous discipline.
I actually agree with the paper's brilliant diagnosis of what it calls mythic traps. The way Sahaly breaks down how necessary human functions lose their answerability to life is masterful.
It's a great breakdown.
It really is. However, I come at it from a different way when we talk about the solution. Creating a 10-question recursive life coherence audit completely ignores the sheer gravity of the institutional forces we are dealing with here.
How so? Because the audit explicitly targets those forces?
Because of the Trojan horse trap. Sahali warns us about the Trojan horse trap, where gifts carry capture, and the Narcissus trap, where an institution basically falls in love with its own reflection. Yet by formalizing life coherence into an audit, we are handing a beautifully constructed new Trojan horse directly to global bureaucracies.
Well,
they will inevitably absorb this framework as a reputational branding device. It's what they do.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on how the audit actually functions mechanically. The recursive audit isn't a passive ESG checklist that you just, you know, hand to a corporate bureaucracy to fill out and file away. It acts much more like a civilizational immune system.
Okay, an immune system. Walk me through that.
Think about how a biological immune system detects foreign pathogens that threaten the organism's autopoiesis. And for those listening who aren't biologists, autopoiesis just means a living system's ability to self-maintain and self-produce. Your cells do it every day. The recursive audit is designed to detect when a metric has stopped serving life and become a Procrustes trap.
Ah, Procrustes. The mythic innkeeper who forced travelers to fit his bed.
Right.
If they were too short, he stretched them. If they were too tall, he cut off their legs.
Exactly. And we do this with administrative standards all the time. We force living complexity to fit rigid metrics. Let's use a real-world example, carbon offsets. A corporate framework says, we need to capture X tons of carbon to be sustainable. So they buy land and plant a massive monoculture of fast-growing pine trees.
Which meets the carbon metric perfectly.
Right, it fits the Procrustean bed. But in reality, that pine monoculture destroys local biodiversity, it dries up the water table, and it displaces the indigenous community.
Yeah.
The metric was satisfied, but life capacity was devastated. So the recursive audit acts as an immune system by hardwiring specific questions into the assessment. It asks, what life capacity does this reveal? What does it obscure? Who gains voice and who loses voice? It detects when living complexity is being mutilated to fit an administrative standard.
Look, I hear your immune system analogy, but let's be real. If the institution itself is running the audit, that's not an immune system. That's a virus writing its own health report.
I think that's a bit cynical.
It's realistic. I challenge the entire premise. What the audit actually creates is a Sisyphus trap.
The boulder rolling up the hill?
Yes. Sisyphus rolled the boulder up the hill endlessly, without any actual structural release. It always rolled back down. Global governance already executes endless assessments. We have environmental impact statements, human rights audits, sustainability reports.
Sure, but...
Adding a new life coherence audit that explicitly asks what institutions might capture this doesn't magically prevent the capture. Bureaucracies will do exactly what they always do. They will generate massive reports declaring themselves life coherent, replacing actual structural conversion with endless activity.
That's an interesting point, though. I would frame it differently. The reason previous environmental or human rights audits fail and become Sisyphean is precisely because they lack what Sahali calls distinction hygiene.
Distinction hygiene? Explain what you mean by that in this context.
So, previous audits treat life or the environment as just one variable to be optimized alongside profit or efficiency or political power. Distinction hygiene demands that life is the ground of value, not a subset of it. The recursive audit specifically asks, what violence could be justified in this framework's name? And does this still serve life, or has it begun to serve itself?
Right, but...
If a fossil fuel company simply hires life coherence consultants and files reports without altering the material conditions of the ecosystems they operate in, the audit itself categorizes that as life incoherent performance. It formally distinguishes between mere administrative activity and actual structural conversion.
Okay, but walk me through the mechanics of that. You do a distinction hygiene audit. You formally identify that the fossil fuel company is just doing life incoherent performance.
Right.
Who cares? I mean, identifying a bad metric doesn't magically take the weapon out of the institution's hands. If a CEO fails the audit, who pulls their funding? This brings us to the massive tension in the framework, the method of action. How do we actually force them to stop?
Well, that's the thing. Sahali relies heavily on Maturana's concept of the biology of love and the practice of wu-wei, or non-forcing action. The paper argues we shouldn't force life into coherence, because forcing inherently reproduces domination.
And that is exactly where this whole thing falls apart for me. Non-forcing action sounds a lot like doing nothing while the house burns down.
It's not doing nothing. You have to understand Maturana's concept of structural coupling, because we are living systems, not machines. You can't just program a community or an ecosystem from the outside. Systems change according to their own internal dynamics in response to their environment. Therefore, the goal of life coherence is the minimum sufficient intervention to restore the conditions for life. You cultivate the conditions for coherence rather than coercing compliance.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. Non-forcing action is a beautiful philosophical concept for a meditation retreat, but it fundamentally misapprehends the sheer urgency of our planetary crises. Saheli brilliantly identifies the Kronos trap, Kronos being the titan who ate his own children.
Right.
It represents the present devouring the future, like we see with climate overshoot and intergenerational debt. He also identifies the Hydra trap, where you chop off one head and two more grow back because the source patterns remain untouched.
Which is why we need distinction hygiene to get to the source pattern.
But when you are dealing with existential threats, treating institutional resistance merely as information and waiting around to cultivate conditions is suicidal. We are dealing with what the paper calls golems.
Autonomous runaway systems.
Exactly. Global finance algorithms operating at the speed of light. Autonomous weapon systems. Entrenched fossil fuel infrastructure. These are tools that have entirely escaped life-governed use. You cannot wu-wei a golem that is currently destroying the biosphere. Sometimes, to protect life capacity, your intervention must be coercive to stop catastrophic harm.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because you are conflating non-forcing action with passivity, which Saheli explicitly warns against. Non-forcing action doesn't mean standing by and watching a golem crush a city. It means your intervention, even when it is incredibly firm, even when it requires physically dismantling a toxic infrastructure, is governed by care rather than domination.
How do you dismantle an oil rig with care instead of domination?
By separating the life-destroying pattern from the human being enacting it. It's the difference between disarming a violent actor to protect a community and torturing that actor to assert your own moral superiority. Saheli writes that we must oppose the life-destroying pattern without denying the living being.
Okay, but...
If we use the urgency of the Kronos and Hydra traps to justify coercive, dehumanizing domination, if we say the climate emergency is so bad we have to suspend human rights and force compliance, we instantly fall into another trap. We become the very monsters we are fighting. The discipline of Wu-Wei means we seek structural release, not mere victory over an enemy.
But structural release often requires dismantling power structures that will not yield to anything short of coercion. Let's look at how this applies to planetary governance, because that's where theory meets reality. If you're listening to this and thinking, this just sounds like more UN paperwork, how does this actually change anything? That's my exact concern. How does distinction hygiene actually dismantle the fossil fuel economy?
It does it by shifting the foundational logic of what is legally authorized. Take global security as an example. Currently, security is organized around protecting institutional claims. We protect borders, we protect resource extraction, we protect market access. Saheli calls this the Mars-Kronos coupling. We use military as security, Mars, to consume the very resources needed for planetary repair, Kronos.
Right. The military budget eats the climate repair budget.
Exactly. But if a governing body adopts distinction hygiene, they shift the mandate of security from protecting claims to protecting the shared conditions of living. Suddenly, security means ecological stability. It means public health. It means protecting the water table.
In theory.
But if you reground the governing distinctions, you change what is legally and practically authorized. A failing water table becomes a Chapter 7 security threat. That changes where the money flows, who gets deployed, and what actions are justified. That proves the framework is practically transformative, not just theoretical.
That's a compelling argument. But have you considered the Babel trap?
The confusion of languages?
Worse than confusion. The Babel trap is when shared words no longer bring forth shared worlds. You say we shift the definition of security to planetary habitability, That sounds great, but elites and powerful institutions will simply co-opt that exact phrase to authorize their own agendas. Planetary habitability will be used by wealthy nations to justify unilateral geoengineering. They will pump sulfur into the atmosphere and say, we had to do it for life coherence.
But the audit is designed to catch exactly that kind of justification.
Only after the fact. Or worse, they will distinguish marginalized populations, or climate refugees, as threats to habitability. And this leads us to the ultimate danger Saheli outlines, the golden calf trap. This is when the symbol of life replaces life itself. By formalizing this framework, you make it an idol. It becomes a tool of power rather than a servant of the living. The moment you write the audit, the moment you institutionalize distinction hygiene in the United Nations or the World Bank, it ceases to be a living discipline. It becomes a captured symptom.
The risk of the golden calf trap is omnipresent, and I don't deny that. Human beings inevitably try to turn living relationships into stabilized forms. We want the comfort of the X-ray machine we talked about at the beginning. But that is exactly why Saheli insists that life coherence cannot be a finalized doctrine. The defense against the Babel trap, against words being co-opted, is the recursive nature of the audit itself.
But you're just pointing back to the paperwork.
Because the paperwork is explicitly self-correcting. Look at the ninth question of the audit. What living consequences would require revision? If planetary habitability is being used to justify geoengineering that harms local ecosystems, the audit demands we look at who is losing voice. It demands we ask what violence is being justified in its name. The framework has a built-in mechanism for self-disarmament.
A self-disarming mechanism.
Yes. It constantly forces the user to look past the representation, past the golden calf, and back to the living consequence on the ground. It is the most rigorous tool available precisely because it refuses the illusion of a perfect, final doctrine. It offers a real pathway to repair by demanding continuous correction by life itself.
Well, a self-disarming mechanism only works if the institution holding the weapon is willing to pull the lever. And history shows us they rarely are. I mean, I believe Saleh's white paper is an absolute masterclass in diagnosing how necessary human functions lose their answerability to life. The articulation of the mythic traps, Procrustes, Narcissus, the Golem, the Cassandra trap, where warnings are ignored, it's a profound contribution to our understanding of civilizational drift.
Absolutely.
But I maintain that institutionalizing life coherence into formal audit tragically risks turning the cure into just another captured symptom. It relies on a level of institutional humility and emotional discipline, the biology of love, that our current planetary structures are fundamentally designed to actively select against.
I think we have reached a vital point of convergence, though. We both agree on the profound validity of the mythic traps as diagnostic tools, and we both completely agree that our current global systems, economic, political, technological, prioritize their own institutional self-conservation over the actual preservation and expansion of life. The question isn't whether the system is broken. The question is how we survive the repair.
Precisely. And whether the tools of repair can resist becoming part of the machine.
Considering these multiple perspectives, for everyone listening, I highly suggest exploring Dr. Saheli's source material directly. It challenges you to examine how you might be caught in the Sisyphus, Cassandra, or Narcissus traps within your own spheres of influence. Whether you are running a household, a local business, or a global NGO, how are your metrics forcing life to fit a rigid bed?
It forces you to look at your own X-rays, so to speak, and ask if the radiation is doing more harm than good.
Right. We started by talking about that diagnostic landscape and how comforting a clean break on an X-ray can be. Saheli's framework takes away that comfort. It tells us that the way we measure, the way we define the problem, might be authorizing the violence we are trying to stop. And it leaves us with a lingering question. Can we hold our corrective frameworks lightly enough that they genuinely serve life? Or will we inevitably build a golden calf out of our own desperate desire to be cured?